This is Cry Justice with Judy Redlick, examining issues of importance to you, your family, and our community that the other media just won't cover. Now, here's Judy Redlick.
Doesn't it make you feel fulfilled when you're working on a major project and you complete it? Or after you've done a hard day's work and you can lay down to rest and have a good night's sleep? Well, on this edition of Cry Justice, we're going to take a look at the history of Labor Day. And then we're going to look at the Religious Freedom Act and why it's happened to be reenacted and reconsidered in the workplace. I'm Judy Redlick. This is Cry Justice. Please stay tuned. What does Labor Day really mean? I have author and speaker Bill Federer, who has been studying this wonderful history of America for years and years, to share with us some insights on Labor Day.
Well, Labor Day started in 1894. It was signed into law by President Cleveland, Grover Cleveland. The situation back then was the Industrial Revolution, which, you know, invented the cotton gin in the South, which perpetuated slavery, and unfortunately that happened. But in the North, it started the factories, and what happened, people would work in factories, but the factories became almost like slave places themselves. One quick example is the Pullman Railroad Car Company. They made these sleeper cars for the railroad, and the Pullman decided that he would make his factory outside of Chicago, and he would build houses for the factory workers to live in, and he would build grocery stores for the factory workers to shop in, and he would pay the workers in company script. It was not U.S. dollar bills. It was, you know, like coupons with credit from the company. So they would pay their rent to the company in this company money, and they would buy their groceries to the company in company money. And it's like, oh, I owe my soul to the company store. Well, what happened is the demand, there was a depression, and demand for the railroad cars fell. And so they were paying the people less, but keeping the rents the same and the food the same. And so the people would get, just every day they would work, but they would get more in debt to the company.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one example that caused the labor and the workers, you know, in other words, child labor, in other words, women labor and an unsafe condition. And so they demanded a lot of reforms, which were good to have been made. But one was Labor Day. And so it's a day honoring those that work. But the idea of not working on a particular day is part of our history. Matter of fact, during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln issued an order to the troops respecting the Sabbath. He says, the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy orders the observance of the Sabbath by all men in the military and Navy. He says, the importance for man and beast of the prescribed weekly rest, the sacred rights of Christian soldiers and sailors, a becoming deference for the best sentiment of a Christian people, and a due regard for the divine will, demand that Sunday labor in the Army and Navy be reduced to the measure of strict necessity. And then we have General George Washington, in 1780, gave an order to his troops to observe a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer. He says, for certain purposes therein mentioned, that there should be no labor or recreation on that day, and that the chaplains will prepare discourses suited, you know, to the proclamation. So the idea of taking a day off of work, you know, ceasing labor on a particular day, is part of our history. It originally had a religious purpose, but then with Labor Day it was more secular, but, you know, recreation. But labor has always been respected. We have Thomas Jefferson. He writes about a person that labors is close to the Lord, so to speak. He said that we have a enlightened by a benign religion, you know, a peaceful religion. He says, we have happiness in our country. And he says, what more could be added to these blessings? He says, a wise, frugal government which will not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. And then Jefferson, in another place, wrote, Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit for substance and general virtue. And then even Abraham Lincoln, when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he freed all the slaves. He says, January 1st, 1863, by virtue of the power invested in me, I do order and declare that all persons held as slaves shall henceforth be free. And I thereby enjoin that the people so declared to be free to abstain from all violence. And it says, I recommend to them that in all cases where allowed, they labor faithfully for reasonable wages. And upon this act, I invoke the gracious favor of Almighty God. But the idea of labor, you produced property. And the idea of owning property is key to freedom. And Noah Webster, in his Webster's Dictionary of 1828, wrote, the labor of inventing, the labor of making or producing anything, constitutes one of the highest titles to property. It is one of the greatest blessings of civil society. And even the Pope in the early 1900s said an encyclical or letter on labor, he says, every man has by nature the right to possess property as his own. The idea that you work to get your own property, this is opposite of what communist countries would do, because in communist countries you work and whatever you produce belongs to the government. And you, as a matter of fact, you belong to the government. And you belong to the government, your kids belong to the government, everything you own, you don't own it, the government owns it, they're letting you have it. And so it takes away all the incentive. And of course in the Middle Ages it was the same thing with the kings. The king would own the land, and you would work the king's land, and he would allow you to keep a little bit of it, but you were a serf. You owed him your life and allegiance. And so the idea of being able to labor and get your own property is a freedom that America helped introduce to the world. And so on Labor Day, we can appreciate that. And then when you look in history, through all the different proclamations that the different presidents have given, they always give thanks to God for blessing the labor. Andrew Jackson in 1835 said, never in any former period of our history have we had greater reason than now to be thankful to divine providence for the blessing of health and general prosperity. Every branch of labor we see crowned with the most abundant rewards. And it goes on and on with the other different presidents. John Tyler, who was the 10th president, said, while in other nations, steady and industrious labor can hardly find the means of subsistence, if you work hard, you can hardly subsist. He says, the greatest evil which we have encountered is a surplus of production beyond the home market. And so we've been blessed throughout history, and our labor has been blessed. And all throughout history, we have acknowledged that it's the Lord that blesses the work of our hands.
And where do you think we stand today, Bill, on labor and the blessing of God? Do you think we still have that great blessing? Or do you think that the welfare system has changed a lot of that?
I think it has changed a lot of that. There's a difference between Republican and Democrat, and I don't share this with any partisan flavor, but it's basically one attitude is, I don't want any help from the government, but by golly, I don't want the government to take anything away once I earn it. It's the pioneer spirit of, give me the open frontier and I'll, fend for myself and fight the wild animals and build my cabin and I'll make it on my own. And then the other one is, well, I want the government to take care of me. I want the government to provide, my home, my food, my medicine. I want the government. And the idea is, whatever you trade for security, you lose. If you trade freedom for security, you won't have either. Because ultimately, the most secure place is the prison cell. The government houses you, clothes you, feeds you, but there's no freedom for anything. So freedom inherently involves risks. And so if you want freedom, you have to be willing to take the risks. If you want security, you've got to give up the freedom. It's a trade-off. It's sort of like in investments. they have what they call a risk-return trade-off. If you want to get a real high return on your investment, you're going to have to take a risky investment. There's a chance you might lose it all. If you want to get a real secure return on your money, well, you can only buy bonds. And you never lose your money with bonds, but the return you get is never very much. It's just a very small percentage point. So it's sort of the same way in the freedom security trade-off. And over the years, gradually, we have been trading off little bits of our freedom to the government in exchange for the government to give us some security. The only problem in the long run is the more the government gets bigger and bigger, the more it is changing from being our servants to our masters. The founders believe that public servants, in America, the people were the king, and the government officials were the public servants. So the people were the king, and they hired servants in the court, you know. So all the politicians were our servants. But over the years, that's changed to where now we think of politicians as our masters, and that they're the ones that tell us how to live our lives. So, one of the founders said the first thing in a free government is to make laws strong enough for the people to obey. But he says the next problem is making laws so that the lawmakers will obey the laws, to have the government be able to limit itself. And but where we're at today, I do see that we can only have one savior, and it's either the government or God. And unfortunately, a lot of times we look to the government, and that sort of robs our faith. And it's tough, my wife and I. We both sort of are self-employed, and so we don't know where the money's going to come from the next month. And a lot of times it's very nerve-wracking. But that's a trade-off that you have in a free country. One of the quotes, Abraham Lincoln was the one that instituted an annual National Day of Thanksgiving to Almighty God. So every president from Lincoln until now has issued a Day of Thanksgiving. And this is what Lincoln wrote in 1864. He says, "It has also pleased our Heavenly Father to favor as well our citizens in their homes as well as the soldiers in their camps." And it says, "He has crowned the labor of our workmen in every department of industry with abundant rewards." So here's Lincoln. He's the one that put "In God We Trust" on our pennies, on our coins, thanking God for our labor bringing forth abundant rewards.
Bill Federer with some insights about Labor Day. Bill, if people would like to get some of your books or have you come speak, what's your phone number up there on your website?
Oh, thank you, Judy. The phone number is 1-888-USA-WORD, 1-888-USA-WORD. And we have a website. It's AmericanBooks.info, AmericanBooks.info.
And some of the books and CDs that you have available?
Well, there's America's God and Country Encyclopedia Quotations.
That's a wonderful little book.
845-page book. And then we have a CD-ROM called American Quotations. You put it in your computer and you pull up all the quotes with that word in it, and you can block and paste the quotes from the presidents. So, I like to say from George Washington to George Washington Carver. And then we have a book on George Washington Carver, his life and faith in his own words.
That's your newest book, isn't it, Bill?
Yes, and then another one sort of at the same time is on St. Patrick. And, St. Patrick lived at a time when the Roman Empire was crumbling. And they had, all kinds of sexual perversion in Rome, and they had huge taxes, and they had people moving out of the city centers into the county. And then they had all these tribes, the Germans and the Franks and so forth, coming through. One of the tribes' name was Vandals, and you can imagine what they did when they went through. They vandalized. So Rome had all these immigrants coming in, keeping their own languages, and it sort of broke up the empire. And then Attila the Hun swept through, and he would murder and butcher thousands of people, entire cities and towns. So it was a tremendous terrorism. And out of that, there was this little 16-year-old boy kidnapped from England and made a slave over in Ireland for 6 years. And he escaped, and when he was about 40, he had a dream of going back to Ireland, and he did, and he evangelized it and baptized 120,000 people and started 300 churches. And it was the Irish Christians that he converted that went back to Europe in the next century and converted all those tribes. And so here a little 16-year-old boy helped spread Christianity in a powerful way.
One small voice made a difference, right, Bill?
Yes.
Bill Federer, 1-888-USA-WORD. For more information about his books and all the neat stuff that he's doing, Bill, I really appreciate you for being my guest and also for standing up for what you believe in sharing such valuable information to people all over the world.
Thank you, Judy.
Alan Reinach, spokesman for Workplace Religious Freedom Coalition. Do we really need a coalition for workplace religious freedom today? Let's ask him. Alan, why did you form this coalition? Do we really need it in America today?
Judy, we absolutely do. In a culture where there's so much emphasis on diversity, on accepting people of all faiths, there's been so much outrage about the Ninth Circuit decision striking down God's name in the pledge. There's a lot of focus on some of the symbolic aspects of how religion impacts on public life. But where the rubber meets the road is when people go to work every day and they are forced to leave their religion at the door, or they're told that if they don't violate their faith, they're out of a job.
So where do we stand on that today?
Where we stand is that the laws that Congress passed a generation ago to protect our civil rights have been steadily eroded by the courts, so that religious discrimination is a third-class right. It is not adequately protected by law. And now we're asking Congress basically to restore what it was that they originally intended to do, which is outlaw religious discrimination at work.
So the Workplace Religious Freedom Act was passed like 20 years ago, and now it's been eroding.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
No, the Workplace Religious Freedom Act is a new bill to restore the kind of legal standard that we think Congress originally intended in the Civil Rights Act that was passed originally in 1964 and then amended in 1972.
So what are some of the tenets in the Workplace Religious Freedom Act that have to be restored?
Well, the legal standard that Congress first enacted said that employers must reasonably accommodate the religious needs of their employees, but short of incurring an undue hardship. It's a reasonable balancing standard. Employees go to work to serve the interests of the company, and those interests ought to be fulfilled. They ought to be able to do the job they were hired to do. So at some point, the burden on the employer becomes too great, and they don't have to accommodate the needs, the religious needs of the employee. The problem is that the courts have basically shifted that balance now so that it weighs almost entirely in favor of the employer. And too many companies are basically thumbing their nose at requests for religious accommodation and saying to the employees, you know, we really don't have to do anything, and we can't be bothered. Or, you know, for whatever reason, they don't comply with even the limited legal obligations that they have now.
So
what we're trying to do is restore that balance to put some more teeth in the law.
So religious freedom, so reasonable accommodations. Are we talking about rooms to have Bible studies in? What all are we talking about here?
The vast majority of the cases involve scheduling issues. Seventh-day Adventists who won't work from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday on their Sabbath. Other Christians or Catholics who don't want to work on Sunday. Muslims, perhaps, wanting to take time off Friday afternoons for prayer. Jews who don't work on Sabbath or want accommodation for the religious holidays. These are the bulk of the problems, but there are other problems. There's problems, and I think the next major source of difficulty are dress and appearance requirements, whether it's wearing of a cross or wearing of a yarmulke, or perhaps a Sikh who wants to wear a turban, or a Muslim woman who wants to wear her head scarf.
Go ahead.
Well, just that. Those are the various appearance problems. Some people have religious requirements with respect to hair length or of beards. And these are all things that can cause conflicts at work.
How about talking about their religion on the job? What provisions were made concerning that years ago, and is that being thwarted today?
It, to the extent, religious accommodation does apply to, if you want to call it witnessing on the job or speaking about religious subjects on the job. Think of it this way. Employees do not completely lose their rights to free speech when they go to work. To the extent that they're entitled to talk with their coworkers about Monday night football or, you know, what they did on their summer vacation, they have just as much right to talk about what they did in church or, you know, after 9/11, you know, how they make sense of the things that you can't make sense of in this world. They have that right, but there are limits to that right. Obviously, at the point where somebody's sharing of their faith and their religious perspective becomes too obnoxious and too aggressive, an employee has the right to say stop, and an employer has the right to say stop, you know, this is getting out of hand and it's unwanted, and the employer has an obligation to protect the employees from religious harassment. There are a few, but very few, reported cases of religious harassment. So I would say on balance, the larger problem is not with believers being so aggressive and so obnoxious that they're offending or hurting other people. It's with very cautious employers being a little heavy-handed in restricting the free speech rights of employees.
So the Workplace Religious Freedom Act, how is that going to help teachers in schools, or is that going to do anything to help keep prayer on the basketball court when the team wants to pray before a game or at commencement services?
No, it really it's specifically employment related, and those are all situations that invoke the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and the principles of government neutrality towards religion. When it comes to what happens in public institutions and public schools. So this bill really does not have any particular impact on those sorts of situations.
So where are we with the Workplace Religious Freedom Act? Is it before Congress?
Well, we have very strong support now in the U.S. Senate. There are 15 senators, very powerful senators from both parties, backing the bill. It's not a partisan effort. You know, there's religious groups across the religious and political spectrum supporting the bill. So it's Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, other religions, liberal, conservative. And we think we have a pretty good shot at getting a vote in the Senate this year. And if we get it voted in the Senate, it could very well get passed in the House as well. Right now, what we're hearing from some senators is, well, we're not terribly interested in the bill because we're not hearing from our constituents. And that's where I hope your listening audience will respond. Missouri is one of those states where your senators have said to us, we're not that interested in the bill because we haven't heard from constituents. So we have a petition drive on our website or on a website on conservativepetitions.com.
Conservativepetitions.com.
Correct. It's very easy to log on and send a message to your senators and also to your congressmen that you want them to care about the Workplace Religious Freedom Act. And then, see, once you sign the petition, if we need further help, like phone calls or letters, then we know how to contact you and urge you to help us even further. But this is the first step, is just to sign the petition at conservativepetitions.com.
Conservativepetitions.com. We've been talking with Alan Reinach, Workplace Religious Freedom Act Coalition spokesman. Alan, in closing, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I represent hundreds of people, or we serve hundreds of people every year who have these problems. and the load of guilt that people bear when they're forced to work in violation of their faith, work on a Sabbath or on a Sunday. And all I can say is no American should be forced to make that choice between their religion and their job. And this bill will go a long way towards ensuring that companies do the right thing.
Get involved. Contact your senators. Let them know what you think about the Workplace Religious Freedom Act they're trying to pass to bring back some of the constitutional rights that you need on the workplace. A couple of other websites you might want to go to find out more about workplace freedoms, www.churchstates.org. That's www.churchstate.org and www.freedomsring. That's freedomsring.com. Alan, thank you very much. I hope that persons will continue to contact their legislators, get more involved in contacting their legislators so our legislators will know how to vote in keeping America free.
Thank you so much, Judy.
My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside led my native country, thee, land of the noble free, thy name, my love. I love thy rocks and rills, thy woods and templed hills, my heart with rapture thrills like that above.
Let music swell the breeze and ring from all the trees sweet freedom song.
Let mortal tongues awake, let all that breathe partake, let rocks their silence break the sound.
This is Cry Justice. I'm Judy Redlich. Email me with your comments to knlc24judy@hearshelpnet.org. Please join me next time.